I like to tell my PhD buddies that I work for a living. My degrees are in performance. I want to talk to you tonight about music, where it comes from and why it's the way it is. And to do that, I want to play a little example on the piano here. I'm not going to perform, but I want to use the piano as a sort of tool to show you something about what music actually is. You know, in the ancient Greek world, there were two kinds of education. There was education for the slave, and there was education for the free man. Education for the slave was education that was vocational in nature. That is, if you had a slave that was showed some ability with numbers, well, then you maybe taught him to do accounting. If he was very good at with hammer and chisel and so on, well, maybe you make him a shipbuilder or a stone cutter or something. And so the education that slave would get would be specific to that job, you see. But the education for a free man was what we call today a liberal arts education. Liberal is the word for free, right? That's where it comes from. So a free education, a liberal education, doesn't have anything to do with political liberalism or theological liberalism. It has to do with being free. And the free education for the Greek came in two parts. The Greeks, you know, had a rather bifurcated view of the human being. Our last speaker made allusion to it, that they would think in a kind of dualism. That is, that the body and the soul were two separate entities, and the soul was somehow good, and the body was sort of corrupt, and we call that Greek dualism, and it's not a very Christian picture, frankly, at all. But, however, that's how they thought. And their education went along with that idea of the human being, you see. Once they understood what they thought the human being was, then they built their education around that. So, there was education for the body, and there was education for the soul. The education for the body, it makes sense, it was gymnastics. That's where we get that word gymnasium and gymnastics. Well, but education for the soul was different. Education for the soul was called music. Now, I wonder why. Why would they call music an education for the soul? Well, Plato, at times, in the Symposium and in the Republic, both speaks about how it is that young people need to understand and be exposed to beautiful music when they're very young. And the reason that they do that, he said, is so that when they get older and they begin to reason, they will have already attached in their hearts a love for beauty. Well, what do they mean by beauty? And why is beauty coming from music? Well, some of this is going to be expounded on in my last lecture tomorrow. But for the moment anyway, let's say, that harmony, it turns out, was a physical characteristic of music. Harmony was something that was physically present in music. And we owe this understanding to people like Pythagoras. You've heard of the Pythagorean theorem, you know, about triangles and so on. That the square of the sum of the two sides is equal to the square of the hypotenuse of a right triangle. Well, that's the same Pythagoras, but this Pythagoras also studied at length, no pun intended, the lengths of strings. He studied harmony. He's the fellow who sort of discovered for us the nature of the mathematical aspects of harmony. Well, the connection, and that's what I'm going to talk about in a minute, the mathematical aspects of harmony. But the reason that you want to teach young people harmony early on, Plato said, is that you want them to, as they get older, learn to attach that love for harmony to other things. That is, metaphorical harmony, like harmony of a good marriage, say, or the harmony of a good business deal, a win-win business deal. And ultimately, Plato argued, that harmony was what led you to a love of justice. He believed that justice was a kind of harmony. Now, if you think of harmony as the comparison of two things, remember this morning's or this afternoon's talk, I was talking about metaphors. This ties right in. A metaphor is the combination or the association of two things, linking them together without using the words like or as, which makes it a simile, right? But a metaphor is this combination or this association of two different things. In comparison to these two different things. Well, harmony turns out to be the same thing. Harmony is the comparison of two different frequencies, two different vibrations per second, frequencies, that happen to fit together. You can't have harmony in a unison. That's not what we call harmony. But this is harmonious. And the reason it is that these other pitches are actually found in that lower pitch. They're actually in it. This note being played for you now, you'd probably better do it down a few octaves. Let's hear it down here. There we go. That note actually has more than one pitch in it. And if you listen carefully, you can hear them. Can you hear this note? Piano's a little bit out of tune, but that's a little flat. But you hear it, though. It's in there. And this note, listen for this one. There it is. Can you hear it? There. And this one. That one's really loud. Listen, you have to wait for the original. This is why I put the mic here, because it's really hard to hear it. Hopefully we'll amplify it a little bit and you can hear it. As the initial volume of the note disappears, you'll hear a kind of haze above it of other pitches. Listen. That's really loud in there. I can hear it at least from this angle. Can you hear that note in it? Well, it turns out that that note is a particular evenly divided division of that previous note. The low note, if divided into smallest parts, comes up with that one. One half of this string, for example, exactly ratio of 2:1, gives you this pitch. It just happens to. This is the way anything vibrates. This is not just the way the piano vibrates. This is any string, any column of air, anything. In fact, the chair you're sitting in, if you could isolate the pitches, vibrates the same way. This is simply the way God designed the world to be. Okay? So we build these instruments based on the physics that I'm actually going to give you right now. One half of that string is that pitch. It just happens to be. Exactly one third of that string is that pitch right there. One fourth of that string is this pitch. One fifth of that string is this pitch. One sixth of that string is this pitch. It just happens to be. So when I play this one up here, it's actually one tenth of that string. You can hear it. Boy, how loud is that? It's almost like I'm playing them together. It's like I'm doing that. Listen. Yeah. There. It just pops right out. So here, I'm going to do a little experiment for you. You know how the piano works, right? There are keys in here that once pushed down, take a damper off of a string so it's free to vibrate. And then swats it from underneath with a hammer. Bang, like that. And it vibrates until you let the key up when the damper falls down and the pitch stops. See? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this low note that I've been playing for you. And I'm just going to hold down the keys so that I lift the dampers off the strings without hitting them with the hammers. If I actually played them, it would sound like that. These are all notes I'm arguing are in that low pitch. But I'm going to just push the dampers down like that without letting the hammers strike the strings. Now, the strings are not vibrating. You can't hear them. But if they are indeed in this low note, then when I let go of the low note and stop it with the dampers, these others will sympathetically vibrate, and you'll hear them. Okay, so here, what you're going to listen for is a very soft version of this. Okay, listen for that. Whoops, sorry. Okay, here we go. Can you hear them? They're all there. Isn't that cool? Now, just to prove that this is, let me do this scientifically, I'm going to play this chord, which is a half a step higher than that. Can you hear it? I'm going to play that chord, hold it down, and see if it vibrates the same way. Because if it does, then this low note actually just sets up sympathetic vibrations with all pitches. But if it doesn't, then you know it's only the ones that I was telling you about. Listen. Nothing. Now, it happens that if I play the string that is the low fundamental, they call that the fundamental of this chord, but if I play the fundamental note for this chord, I'm not changing my right hand, then you'll hear it. Listen. There they are. Can you hear it? Loud as a bell. That's because only when the what they call unit fractions are in place does it work. If you take this low string and you divide it exactly in half, you get that pitch. So you get, let's see if I can get it. Hear it? So, and then in a third you get this pitch. Hear it? And a fourth is every time you double any frequency, you get an octave higher. So if this is one and this is twice it, then four times it would be this C, this octave. Let's see if it's in there. Hello, yeah, it's there. Yeah, it's there. A fifth of the string is this one. Ooh, that's a little out of, didn't I tell you it was out of tune? It doesn't work if it's not quite in tune. Yeah, I can hear this one better than this one. A sixth of the string would be this one. Here it is. Anyway, you get the idea. So, what's interesting is that things that sound pleasant to our ears, like that, sound pleasant because of the physics of it. It's not accidental, you see? It's because those notes are in that one. If I played these notes with this note, it sounds dissonant to our ears, unless you make it jazzy. Okay, so, but certain notes don't, like that doesn't sound good with this note. Why is that? Because this note here is not in that note there. It's just not, see? And it sounds like it wants to be resolved to there. Ah, relief. See what I mean? So, that's how music works, actually. We build up harmonies that are full of tension and then get released. Tension and then release. That's what music is all about. So, when Pythagoras figured this out, he said, I want you to teach music, this to people. Because when you do, they will be actually, they will be changed. He believed that they would be changed on the inside by the harmony on the outside. The things that sounded good on the outside, like that, would actually help order your interior soul. And the point of it all was, is to have a harmonious soul. Now, here's the problem, of course, with Greek thinking. They didn't have Jesus, did they? There's no way you can accomplish this without someone stepping in and taking over and dealing with the sin question and then teaching you what harmony really was supposed to be all about. But The harmony that you find in these chords is actually part of the universe that God made, and we know that from Him and through Him and to Him are all things, including harmony. So this is just the way God made the world to vibrate. The interesting thing about Plato, and the reason I bring up the Greek idea, is that they had a much more sophisticated and much more detailed idea about what the purpose was for music than we do today. We may not be making the same mistakes that the Greeks made, but we make another kind of mistake. We make the mistake that the Epicureans made, I guess. We make the mistakes that we think that music is for the most part for the purposes of momentary diversion. Music is a pleasant diversion from real life. And I want to continue in my little talk here about the Greeks for a second in order to give you a little taste of what it is they actually did think music was for. The word music comes from the muses. Have you heard of the muses? How many muses were there? Nine, very good. Anybody know what they were? Who they were? Can you name them? Thoreau, very good. What did they inspire? The arts and sciences too. Did you know that? Yeah, good. Who was the father of the muses? Zeus. Yeah, somebody said it. The father of the muses was Zeus, and so in a mythological sort of hierarchy, you have to understand this stuff metaphorically, right? I'm not preaching mythology. I mean, I'm not saying these are real any gods. But in their attempt to make sense of the world, they said that Zeus, the most powerful of the gods, is the father of all nine of these muses. And what was, you know, the mother's name? That's where everybody gets hung up. Most people don't remember their mother's name. Okay, hang on to that a second. I'll tell you in a second because it's really important. What did the muses inspire? Do you remember? Can anybody name one of them? History. Very good. Cleo was the muse of history. What else? Music, yes. Poetry, what kind of poetry? Anne Bradstreet was the 10th muse? I didn't know that. Oh, very cool. What they did inspire poetry, though, epic poetry in particular, right? Epic poetry was the sort of top muse. Who wrote epic poetry for the Greeks? Homer, there you go. Calliope inspired Homer, supposedly, to write the Odyssey and the Iliad, right? Okay. Well, okay, so there's epic poetry, but there's also love poetry. There's lyric poetry. So there's a different muse for lyric poetry. So we've got, what did we say? History, music, epic poetry, lyric poetry. What else? Math, did you say? No? Not specifically. Not biology. Drama, very good. Yeah, how do you divide drama? There are two of them. Tragedies and comedies. There you go. So there are two more. That's right. Comedy, tragedy. And then dance. Terpsichore was the muse of dance. We said history. Let's see, what am I missing? Oh, mythology. What they would call theology, we call mythology. And then one last one. Astronomy. Astronomy. So, the nine muses inspired all of those things, that what we might call today the arts and sciences in the university education. History, epic poetry, lyric poetry, comedy and drama, music, theology, we would call mythology, dance, and astronomy. Now, how did they go about inspiring these things? Well, the answer is they sang them. So the idea is that the harmony that Pythagoras was understanding about the way strings vibrate was part of the inspiration of the muses, so that this beauty was understood to be a kind of from afar, from, you know, beyond the mortal realms. This is a sort of immortal thing called beauty that comes about by singing, and this singing inspires not just music, but everything, all these nine that we've talked about, that are such important aspects of the creativity of human beings. knowing the way that the planets revolve and travel through space and so on, was considered to be a harmonious practice. They saw how the numbers fit the various orbits of the various planets. Of course, they were mistaken about some things, weren't they? But they were giving it their best shot. They believed in a geocentric universe. We believe, understand, a heliocentric universe. But never mind. They called it the music of the spheres. They said music. They used the word music to describe the solar system and the way it was designed, because they believed that there was a logos. You know that the Greeks used that word. Don't you? That wasn't just a John word. John used it in John 1 to describe Jesus. But when he did it because they already knew that word, right? He was speaking to the Greeks, and so he said, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word, and the Logos was God. And most Greeks then would say, duh, or something equivalent. They probably had a more sophisticated way to say it. But they knew that, right? They understood that. The problem wasn't that they didn't believe that the Logos was God. They did call him, even Plato would call him the God. But what they didn't get, and what really caused them trouble, was later on in John 1, where he says, and the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us. That's when all the Greeks said, check please, I'm out of here, that's crazy. You're nuts. Because they saw the Logos as this ordering principle that held the solar system together, do you see? This is the music of the spheres they were thinking of. This is the ordering of the universe, brought about who knows how, right? By this sort of impersonal power. Well, we Christians realize, and John told us about it, with God's inspiration, that the organizing principle, if you will, actually came flesh and dwelt among us, and he walked around, who was crucified and resurrected, is the guy who put the planets in order. He is the guy who set the order to the universe. It's pretty astounding if you think about it. So the nine muses sang their inspiration. Now, if you want to be inspired, then, in the Greek mind, you would turn to the muses. You would hope that the muses would inspire you. I was going to tell you about the name of the mother of the muses. You know, Zeus was a bit of a cad. He was always finding some other woman to have children with, and this woman was no different. I mean, he had children by many different women in mythology. But the mother of the muses, you understand, all this was sort of, well, it's an attempt, the mythology is an attempt to get at a truth that they couldn't figure out any other way. They personified this truth in some way. Well, there's a lot of truth in what they were saying about the inspiration of this beauty from harmony, because music really does come from God, ultimately. And beauty is something that is so wrapped up and attached to God that it's hard to separate them. We'll talk about that tomorrow. But the mother of the muses in Greek mythology was called Mnemosyne. Mnemosyne. And Mnemosyne is the word for memory. So the muses sang their inspiration, but if you really wanted to be inspired, you had to have the muses. The muses weren't possible without knowing your history, without knowing where you came from, knowing what you were building on. And so the strength of Zeus, the inspiration of Zeus, and the history, the knowledge of the past that came from memory, joined together and give us the nine arts, these nine arts. Now, I'm a bit of an amateur etymologist. I like the way words work, where they come from, all that sort of thing. If you put the letter A as a prefix for a word, what happens to it? Yeah, it puts the opposite of it, right? It negates it. So a theist is somebody who believes in God. An atheist is somebody who believes there's no God or doesn't believe in God, right? Tonality is one thing. Atonality is its opposite. Okay. So how about if we use the word music to describe all of this wonderful stuff that these nine muses are inspiring? Knowledge of history, knowledge of poetry, knowledge of comedy and drama, knowledge of music and theology and science, if all those things are actually tied up in all this music, then the work that we do in those areas could be called being mused. Right? Here I am composing music, and I'm inspired, and so I'm called, I could call myself being mused. Do you see what I mean? Okay, well, if I put an A in front of that word, what does amused mean? What do you think? Being entertained, sure. To be amused would be to not be inspired, right? So to be, we use the word to be entertained, don't we? We use it like an amusement park we talk about. Well, an amusement park is a place that you go to study, right? No, no. You go there for a momentary break from studying, don't you? That's what the amusement park is for. Well, this is a little sleight of hand irony maybe, but take a look at this. I want to argue that today in our culture, we actually don't appreciate the beauty of music for its own sake. We think of it as a sort of commodity to be ingested while we are waiting for something important to happen. You see? So I would argue that today we use music to amuse ourselves. Can you follow that? This is so far from that old Greek mind, or, for that matter, all the inspiration that has come in following centuries in the West after Jesus. Because, let me just give you an example. You know Milton, right? What was Milton's big accomplishment? Paradise Lost, right. In the very first page of Paradise Lost, you'll find him doing just what Homer did. If you look around, look, Homer will, at the beginning of the Iliad, the end of the Odyssey, in both of those, he sings to the muse, and he begs the muse to inspire him to write this epic. Well, Milton knew his history. Milton knew what an epic was. And he was writing an epic called Paradise Lost. And so, in the first few lines, 16 lines in or so, he calls on the muse to inspire him, just like Homer did. So he's going right along with it. Except that Milton was a Christian. And so Milton makes it very clear that the muse he's calling on is the Holy Spirit. And that's the one, he's the one, I should say, that was doing any kind of inspiration back then, even in the Greek time. See? They just didn't know what to call him. Now we know. Now we know. So, but the inspiration is the same, isn't it? I mean, now we're talking about being inspired by the God who made the universe. The creativity that we have to make music, to recognize relationships in the physical world, to study theater, to write plays, to write epic poems, to make metaphors like we were talking about earlier today, all those things, I actually think come inspired by the muse. And I say the Holy Spirit instead of the muse. Art turns out to be something that's very, very important. Art in that general way. And I think what we've been doing in the last couple of generations is we have lost track of that important aspect of music. And we think of it now as the thing that we use to sort of fill in time between two really important things. Like when you're waiting in the dentist office, you play music through the speakers. The reason for that? Well, I was doing something important before I came to the dentist, and right now I'm waiting for the dentist to actually clean my teeth, but while I'm waiting, doing nothing, I'll listen to music, see? The other way is when you get in the car and you drive someplace, right? Oh, I'm home right now, and that's important. Then I'm going to be driving to my whatever I'm doing. But in the meantime, I'm going to turn on music, see, to sort of while away the time. And so we have this idea that music is a kind of a filler, kind of like a bit of styrofoam to keep two sharp edges from touching each other, or we use it as a marching band between the two halves of the football game. You know, the football game, now that's important. But we sort of interject the marching band in between so that everybody, while the athletes rest, you know, and before they can come out and finish this wonderful game, we'll entertain the people with a little. Why do they keep calling it music, I wonder? Anyway, what I thought we would do is play a few bits of music to talk about how in the past people have actually argued that music is beautiful. You okay with this? Can I play you a couple of examples? Do you know, what I'm going to try and explain is that there are things going on in music that most people don't actually hear, most people don't listen for, unless somebody's pointing them out to them. This is how I would be if I walked through a nuclear reactor, okay? Somebody would have to point out to me what's going on in terms of physics. That's a dial, that's a button, don't touch this button, you know. What do I know about nuclear fusion, right, or fission, I mean, fusion, I guess. Anyway, see, I don't even know which word to use, anyway. I guess they have fusion reactors, don't they? Is that right? No, not like it's fission reactors, then. Thank you. See, I'm learning. Well, anyway, I just want to point out a few things. Let me give you a quick example or two. Do you know Handel's Messiah? Yeah? Okay. Do you know the first, the tenor aria that he sings at the very beginning? Every valley shall be exalted. He sings, every valley, you have to suffer with my voice, every valley shall be exalted, right? Shall be exalted. Now the question is, I'm going to actually play a real tenor in a minute, and then you'll stop clapping for me. The question I was asking this morning, or this afternoon rather, were about Shakespeare's example and about the Job 28. The question is, why did he write it this way? Why not another way? Why is this important? So the word that I just sang in that, what they call a melisma, if you don't want another technical term, a melisma is when there are many, many notes and only one syllable. So you're singing the same syllable over the course of many notes. As opposed to syllabic, like, a mighty fortress, it is our God, it's almost syllabic. A mighty are three different words, right? But if it was, a mighty, melismatic. Are you with me, Siva? Sorry about that. Anyway, that's the way it was. The question is, what was he singing? What word was he singing on that melisma? Did you catch it? Exalted, that's right. What does exalted mean? To be lifted up, right? When something is exalted, it's lifted up like this. Okay, well, the music went, didn't it? Can you play that first example for me? Fellas in the back, here we go. This This is a communication. This is a communication at a particular level. This is an interpretation of that text. That's the text, that verse, right? He's taking this verse and he's saying, what does it mean? What does it say? And how can my music bring that out, bring it out and describe it to the audience? Now, if you've listened to, how many of you have heard that aria before? Okay, how many of you have thought about it that way before? Oh, good if you have. That's very good. Yeah. Well, that's rare. You know, people don't usually think of it that way. However, once you start listening to pieces in the Baroque period, you'll hear that kind of tone painting throughout. Can you go ahead, jump down to, it says Bach, Mass in B minor, and it'll say, et, et, incarnatus est. Can you see that one? It's about 5 or 6 down, maybe. E-T-I-N-C-A-R, natus, est. This is a bit of Bach's Mass in B minor, and he is setting the text from the Nicene Creed, what they call the Credo, in the old Mass, the old Roman Mass. The Credo is just the Nicene Creed. You know how it goes. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in all things, who made all things visible and invisible, and so on. He gets to the part about, you got it? It's further down another one or two. Et incarnatus. Got it? Okay. This is a moment in the second part. You know, the Nicene Creed is in three parts. Talks about the Father, talks about the Son, talks about the Holy Spirit, and then the Catholic Church and the forgiveness of sins and so on. Well, in the part about the Son, it speaks about him being born. And in Latin it is es incarnatus est, and was born, incarnated. And the text is et incarnatus est, de Spiritu Sancto, by the Holy Spirit, ex Maria Virgini, of the Virgin Mary. And so what he does, this is far more sophisticated than the little tenor aria we just heard, but it's the same idea. The music is actually painting the meaning and interpreting the meaning of that text. So listen to it once. I'll let you hear the first 30 seconds of it, and then I'm going to stop, and I'll show it to you, and then I'll play it for you again so you can hear it the second time. Okay? Et incarnatus est. Jump back to the beginning and I'll play it for him again in just a second. Could you hear what was going on? It's a little hard to hear, at least where I'm standing. This recording is not as clean as I'd like it. But the orchestra plays a little bit to begin with, kind of sets up a carpet. And then what you hear is some women singing, Et incarna, like that, an octave higher. And then another group going, when they get to na, the next group goes, Et incarna, and the spread, Et incarna, And then the bass is et incarnatus est. Okay? So what's the point? Why is he writing it that way? Et incarnat. Et incarnat. Et incarnat. Et incarnat. Et incarnat. Just say it, for heaven's sake. Yeah, somebody said it, yeah? What did you say? He's coming down. The incarnation is one of the great miracles and mysteries, isn't it? How on earth indeed, did Jesus come to be? How can that conception have happened? It's impossible, right? All things are possible with God. It's a miracle. This is one of the great miracles of the Christian faith. But it's a mystery. How can anybody understand it? Frankly, how can you understand it even in the normal way? I don't know. Seems to me every child conceived is a miracle. It's an astonishing thing. But certainly astonishing if there's no dad, right? Very impressive. Okay, well, it's something that Bach then meditated on for a long time and thought about when he was going to set this particular part of the Nicene Creed. He thought, how can I express this? And he very, very, very gently descends, has the Spirit descend like that. Isn't that marvelous? And when it says De Spiritus Sancto, there's this little sort of crescendo, decrescendo like this, as though it sort of appears and then disappears again, of the Holy Spirit. The Spirit who comes and goes as He pleases, like the wind, we're told. Amazing. And then, when He speaks of Ex Maria, of the Virgin Mary, Ex Maria Virgine, when He speaks about that, it's in the most tender, tender, gentle way. Ex Maria. Ex Maria. It's this magical touch from the Holy Spirit to Mary that's inexplicable. And I don't know anybody who's come at that as profoundly as this particular moment. I wish I had a little bit better recording for you. Play it again, would you? Maybe you can catch some of it anyway. Ex Maria Virgine. It's another one or two down. That's part of the Gloria. Gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax hominibus. Idea? Now, he put a lot of time into that. He thought that, you know, he was inspired by the muse, I think. That's an amazing moment in music. If you want to know, there are a few, I think if you really want to know Western art and music and so on, culture, there are a few things you have to know. You have to know the Shakespeare plays, you have to know the Rembrandt self-portraits, and you have to know the Bach B minor Mass. Take a note and listen to that. It's very, very long. I'm playing you 30 seconds of one movement out of, I don't know, 17 or something. It's very long, but it's worth it. And if you can get to know it, my old conducting teacher at Indiana said that his church did the B minor mass every year. Think of it. Imagine your church knowing it so well that they do it every year. It's just that great a piece. Okay. Well, some people say, well, okay, music is such an expressive thing, has so much to it. What about when it doesn't have any words? Well, I think music can be very expressive even without words. Let's look at a Mozart horn concerto. About eight down or so, there's a link on there, a file on there called Concerto in E-flat number, let's see, it's number two, movement three, has a Roman numeral three on it. See if you can find it. Might say Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, and then just after that, it has two different horn concerto movements, and one of them says concerto number two, movement three. Now, what I'm going to do is play it for you twice because it's very short. It's only 5 minutes long, okay? But I want you to hear, that's pretty short for a classical piece of music. This is the last movement of a French horn concerto that Mozart wrote in about 1780, something like that. And it's for, you know what a concerto is, right? A concerto is a piece for solo instrument and accompanied by orchestra. So there's a French horn soloist, and he gets to show off, and then the orchestra plays some of the material back to him, and they have a kind of a conversation between them. Well, this is the last movement of this concerto. Most of these concertos were played in the classical classical style. Is called a rondo. It's in the form of a rondo. This may be more material than you want to know, but a rondo has this form. It has A, B, A, C, A, D, A. Can you follow that? There's A material, then there's contrasting B material, and then the A stuff comes back again. And then there's a C material that's different from the B or A, right? And then A comes back again, and then there's D material, new material, and then A comes back again. So it's got a kind of rounded form. They call it rondo because it's rounded. It's balanced and symmetrical. A at the beginning, A at the end, two contrasting sections, two A's, and then right in the middle, the C. So it's very balanced and symmetric. You ought to think of it in terms of, have you seen the Parthenon? Well, you see Greek architecture has a big triangular pediment and then it has all these columns, right? And the columns are balanced on either side. There's like, say, four columns. Is that me? It is me? Did I do that? Sorry. Somebody's setting off fireworks. Anyway. There's balance and symmetry in the order of this Greek Parthenon facade, and you'll see it in lots of different Greek buildings. In Mozart's time, the style of the day in architecture was called neoclassical, and so that's why we call Mozart's music classical, because it's like the old Greek Roman classical architecture. It's got form to it. It's very refined and sophisticated and ordered and balanced and all that stuff. So the rondo is a very sort of balanced and neoclassical form. Rather. Okay, let me play it for you. I may talk a little bit as it goes by, but you'll be able to hear, I think, the various bits. I'll tell you the letters as they go by. How about that? You'll get to hear them. Okay? Let's try. Okay. what they call the coda. Coda in Italian just means tail, just ending. So it's a little coda at the end. Okay, now, how is that expressive music? Certainly it's delightful, it's kind of fun. Well, first of all, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff to say about it. Let's see if I can get it in. First of all, it's a piece for French horn. And the French horn is associated, especially in the 18th century, with horseback riding. Because the French horn was like the horn that they used to go hunting with. Right? Tally-ho! To go get the fox. So, the French horn is sort of associated with horseback riding. Well, Mozart is aware of that little connection. And so he writes the music in 6/8 meter. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, a little bit like a horse galloping. Tigadum, 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 dum 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 dee da da, tigadee da 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 dee da 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 da. It's meant to be understood that way. He knew that people would have the association of the horn with horses, and so his last movement is a kind of a toss-away, fun, delightful little movement, so he associates those two things. Well, here's another little element for you. The fellow that he wrote this concerto for is a fellow called Leutgeb. It's a very unfortunate name. Leutgeb, a German French horn player. And Mozart wrote about him. We know a little bit about him. Mozart thought he was a bit of a buffoon, just a fool. He didn't like him all that much. Well, he wrote this concerto for him, but then he tried to trip him up as he played it. Mozart was a bit of a prankster, you know, a tricky kind of guy. He liked to play tricks on people. So he wrote the first page of the concerto in black ink. When you open the page, the next page is in green ink. And the next page is in red ink, see? And he just did it that way to throw him off, just to give him a hard time. Well, in the B, another of these little moments is in the B section, there's what they call a two-octave arpeggio. If you know, have any played French horn? Anybody horn player? All right. Do you guys know about valveless horns? You know? Well, they used to play horns without valves, right? So every note that you played, you had to manage either with your hand or with your chops, right? Like, the horn would only play certain notes, and you had to adjust everything. It's very difficult to play. French horn is hard to play anyway. But it's really hard to play without valves. And that's the kind of horn that Mozart's guy was using when he played this. Well, he wrote for him a two-octave arpeggio, which goes bum 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 ba. All of that covers all of that range, but really fast, like that. And he wrote a little note in the side, in the margin of the music. Just try and play this, you horse's rear. Now, is that nice? Now, horn players now have worked this up, and now they're all very facile with this. It's so difficult. You have to work very hard to be able to do it. But good horn players can pull it off, and when you listen to it again, you'll hear this guy just tosses it off as though it's not hard at all. He's quite a good horn player. Okay, well, here's another little tidbit, and if you didn't know Mozart, you wouldn't necessarily know this, but Mozart's real claim to fame, I think, in music history is the opera. Mozart was the guy who wrote, well, he wrote a whole lot of operas. I had a music history teacher used to say that Mozart, you know, was a child prodigy, and he would say, he's a little German man, he would say, you know, when Mozart was 3 years old, he wrote his first piece of music, which is true. And when he was 7 years old, he wrote his first symphony, which is also true. And I've heard the piece, by the way, his first symphony at age of 7, and it's excellent. It's really very good. I heard the Philadelphia Orchestra play it one time live, and it's an amazing piece of music for a 7-year-old. But my teacher would say, but this first symphony was a very immature work. I guess so. It's 7 years old. The kid was 7 years old.
He would say, he didn't reach his maturity until he was 12. Which is true, too. When he wrote his first opera. He wrote his first opera when he was 12 years old. It was Beauty and the Beast. Bastien, Bastienne. But after that, of course, Mozart, you know, Mozart lived to be 35. Did you know that? He died when he was 35. So that means when Mozart was my age, he'd been dead for 20 years. Think of that. So what are you doing with your lives? Mozart was an amazing fellow in that way. I mean, he was just almost a freak of nature. He would compose everything in his head before he wrote it down. I'll just give you one more anecdote and then I'll play the music again. I'll get back to the music. He wrote music in his head. Somebody asked him, some duke or somebody wrote him a letter one time and said, how is it you go about composing? And he wrote back and said something like this. He said, every evening after supper, I will either take a walk or a carriage ride. And while I'm on the walk or carriage ride, a little tune will come to my mind. And I'll sing it over to myself in my head. And it will develop itself. It'll become longer. It'll start having more and more facets to it. And by the time I get back home, I will have the entire movement with each instrument's parts clearly in my mind before I come in to write it down. This is utterly fantastic. It's beyond comprehension. And then what he said was, writing it down was so tedious to him, because it's not very interesting to him. You know, the interesting part was actually creating it. But writing it down was tedious, so he would have his wife read to him while he wrote it down. That's what he said. Now, I would think he was just bragging if I hadn't seen some of his original manuscripts. And they are flawless. I went to Salzburg. He was born in Salzburg and in Austria. And under glass, you can see some of the original manuscripts, first copies of several things. I saw the first copy of his vocal score to Così fan tutte, the opera, famous opera. And it is so clear. You understand, he's writing with a quill pen, okay? So you can't erase it. And when he wrote it with a quill pen, he didn't make any mistakes. Why? Because he really did know in his head what everybody was going to do before he started writing it down. Now, other creative geniuses have worked quite differently, but if you look at Beethoven's original scores, they're a mess. You can't even read them. But, great accomplishment, right? But he was constantly scratching things out and writing things in the margin and, you know, cussing and all sorts of things. So, but Mozart's stuff is just like that. So, anyway, okay, well, here, go back to the concerto for a minute. When he gets to the C material, you notice he changed key. For this, you have to understand how the orchestra is set up. The horn player will be standing here, say, looking at you. The conductor will be on his podium with his back to you, right? And the orchestra is laid out in front of him this way. So he can see the horn player, the conductor can see the horn player, and he can conduct the orchestra and accompany the horn player. But that means that the orchestra is behind the horn player. He can't see them at all. Okay. Now, I started all this by telling you that I thought Mozart was a great opera composer. The reason he's a great opera composer is that he was able to write melodies that were so tied to the character that was singing the aria, that you couldn't substitute that aria for somebody else because it is so like Susanna or like the Countess or so like Dorabella or whoever was singing the aria, the song. Previous opera composers had kind of interchangeable, they had a lament and they had a march and they would interchange these sorts of things for different characters and maybe just write different words for them. But with Mozart, the music and the words are so tightly woven together and the personality of the person singing the music is so associated with that particular melody that you can't separate the two. Mozart really did pour a lot of personality into the melodies that he wrote. So that's why you can tell, if you listen to a lot of Mozart's music in his operas, you can tell when he's written a melody that is supposed to be taken seriously and a melody that's a sort of self-spoofing kind of melody, something that's supposed to be not taken seriously. Okay, here's what he writes for the French horn player. He changes key to the minor, and he has the horn player go, ba-dee-da-da, ba-dee-dee-da-da-da-da-da. That is not to be taken seriously. That sounds very serious, but it's not. And I'll tell you why in a minute. Did you ever hear, you know Hamlet? We talked about Hamlet earlier. Do you remember who Polonius is? Who is Polonius? Remember? Laertes' father, exactly. And who else's father? Who's Laertes' sister? Ophelia's sister, right? Ophelia's and Laertes' father is Polonius. And Polonius usually is played as a sort of doddering old man. Usually. Because he's always saying things like, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Things like that. Well, he says, and this above all to thine own self be true, and thus it follows, as day follows night, then thou canst not be false to any man. And he's doing it on the way to sending Laertes back to school. Now, Laertes, let me tell you, neither a borrower nor a lender be, you see. He's supposed, and Laertes is kind of going, yeah, okay, Dad, got it. Okay, sure, fine, that's cool, I got it, okay. I think that's what's going on here, too. You remember now, he thinks the guy playing the French horn, is a dope. Is a kind of a fool, right? Okay, so he writes him a melody that sounds like this. When you go out tonight, you had better wear your shoes. And you might be... Because out in the forest, there might just be a bear or two. Or something. I'm making this up. I had to make it rhyme. I don't know. It's like little arched eyebrow, you know. Now, this is the fun part. Mozart has the horn player play that, and you know the horn takes breath, right? So you have to take a breath every once in a while. Right? Okay. So he writes those little short bits. Okay. In the breath, when the orchestra accompanies him, you hear this. It goes like this. You're getting it already. It's a little laughter. It's like... it's what they call a grace note. For those of you who don't... They're playing da-dum, 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 da-dum really fast. Like that. So listen to it next time we do it. He goes... Again, I'm not making it, it's in the music, okay? It's right there. And one time, the third time, it's way up high in the violin, so you can't miss it. You go, it's really funny. Okay, so, here's the... If you don't think Mozart's a genius yet, let me give you this. Understand, this is in a movement he's tossing off, right? This is just for fun. In the midst of a movement that he's tossing off, he can't help but write glorious melodies. He writes this most absolutely sonorous, beautiful melody in the D section. It goes like this. It goes, da da di da 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 di di da 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 di da da di da 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 di da 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 di da di da da da, like that. It's this heart-beating, romantic kind of aria, like Romeo at the Balcony kind of thing, okay? It's meant to be understood. This is just sheer genius, sheer beauty and genius of Mozart. In the middle of a goofy little piece that he's written about horseback riding and this goofy horn player, he gives him this melody to play that's just like the angels singing. And it's very funny because I want you to, this time when you hear it too, you want to hear the relationship between the horn player and the orchestra. It's like they're two different characters and they're talking to each other, right? Especially when he goes, he takes himself very seriously, a pompous sort of thing. They laugh. Okay, but when he plays, they say, huh. You don't hear any laughter. And they take it up and they all play it. And they love it. You can see they really care about this melody. It's beautiful. Okay, one last thing. You've got A, B, where the arpeggio is. A, C, where the pompous music is and the laughter. A, D, where the Romeo verse is, Romeo melody is. Then there's A again, and it comes back and he goes, bum, bottom, bum, bottom, bum, dee, da, da. This is the 1, 2, 3, fourth time you've heard it now. Bum, bottom, bum, bottom, bum, dee, da, 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 da. I just wanted to be sure you're listening. This is Mozart saying a little like that. He's saying, don't get too complacent. I've given you this melody each time and I know you're expecting it to come back, but it comes back and just wanted you to, it's like somebody who goes, yeah, yeah, and then it goes, what? That's what he's doing. It's a little joke to the audience, a little catch you off guard. And then one last thing. I told you that there's a coda, right? Little tail at the end. And it's the same material. Only it's faster. How many of you have ridden horses? All of you. This is going to be great. When the horse sees the barn, what does he do? Yes! He goes faster, right? He may have gotten to the point where he's going, okay, we're getting all the barn where the hay is. Right? That's what Mozart's referring to. It's a little inside joke about horses. It's not, I'm not kidding, it's all there. So, if you know his music, you know that this, all of this stuff actually does make sense, and this interpretation is only, I mean, it's all based in legitimate stuff. I'm not just making this up. Let's play it again. I'll walk it through and I'll point out those things I just mentioned. Okay? Can we play it all again? So you hear the horn call to begin with, the horn galloping music. That's it. Short one here. Goes, yeah. Let's go back to A. A. Amen. Isn't that fun? That's Mozart for you. How much time do we have? Who's our official timekeeper? Anybody know?
4 hours.
Do you want to do one more? Yeah, you got time for it? We could do one more short thing. Look on there, just above those, I think, is the Mozart Marriage of Figaro. Since I talked about opera, look at the Marriage of Figaro one, you see? Sorry? Opening duet, that's it, right. In the opera Marriage of Figaro, if I had 3 hours, I could tell you the plot. It's very involved and complicated. But it's loads of fun. How many of you have never seen an opera before? Oh, really? Not so many. Okay, more than that. If you ever want to see an opera, but you don't know which one to go to, go to the Marriage of Figaro. It's extremely funny, very funny, very clever, very witty. It's got a really happy ending. Actually, there's even a kind of a Christian redemption kind of twist at the end of it. It's a lot of fun, and it's some of the most glorious music ever written. Some people say it's the best opera ever written. In the opening of The Marriage of Figaro, what you see is this. The curtain, after the overture is played, the curtain goes up on a room, and in the room are two people. One is a man, and he's down on the floor on his knees, and he's got a ruler in his hands, and he's measuring the floor. Okay? That's what he's doing. The other is a woman, and she's standing over on the other side looking in a mirror trying on a hat. Okay? So she's singing about her hat, and he's singing about the floor. Okay? So right off the bat, you know, this is going to be fun. Well, it turns out that he is Figaro, and she is Susanna, and they are going to be married soon, and this is going to be their room in the castle, in the count's castle. They are two servants. He is a servant to the count. She's a servant to the countess. So they're two working class people. Okay, they're servants, but they're getting married. And in the music of this opening, you hear Figaro measuring the floor, and all he's doing is singing the measurements. He goes 5, 10, 20, which means 5, 10, 20, right, in Italian. She sings, oh, isn't this a terrific hat? I think this is the perfect hat for me, okay? Now, her melody and his melody are very different, but it's all under the same sort of foundational, or all above the same foundational music, okay? But they're singing two different things. Okay, now, here's what happens. She decides she wants him, she wants his opinion on the hat. Okay? So you can kind of see it coming, can't you? So she turns and she says, "Won't you look, mio caro Figaro, my darling Figaro? Why don't you? Would you look at me? Isn't this a lovely bonnet? Isn't this a nice hat?" And what does he say? He says, "Cinque, dieci." Pays no attention to her at all. Okay. So then she kind of tries again, right? And third time she kind of. She actually sounds like she nags him a little. You can hear the music going, yet, 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 yet. And at that point, he looks up and he goes, "Si, mio cuore, yes, my love, it's a beautiful hat, just the perfect hat for you." And he goes back to his work, right? He's not really paying attention, okay? And she says, "But look at it." And he goes, "Yes, it's lovely." "No, but look at it." And he goes, "Ugh." And then he finally stops what he's doing and he looks. And she's beautiful. And you can hear it in his music. And he says, "Yes, you are. It is beautiful." And you hear him stand up, basically. If you've got a good stage manager, stage director, the two of them are standing distant from each other. And in this one bit of music, they get closer and closer and closer together. And then they sing together. And they sing in harmony with each other. And it's wonderful. And so you've got two completely different bits of music, right? For two people with their minds in two different directions. And they come together. This is not, well, I'll tell you about it after I play it for you. But this is the opening of the scene. Okay, let's hear the music.
That's
not interested. So the lights go down in the house. Right here, the curtain goes up. And you see them, and he says, Looking at her hat. This is just the perfect hat for me. She says, Guadalupe, poor little Calafiro, look at me. Yes, Guadalupe, look at me. Recitativo, where they talk. I forget how far this goes. How many more? Good. Okay. Well, it's kind of fun to hear. What they're talking about, you're a third officer. But this goes by so quick, if you don't know the Italian, you can't tell. But what they're talking about is, our wedding is going to be really great. And he says, yeah, and I've just figured out that the bed is going to fit in here. That's what he's measured for. So now you get it. You guys, you're very quick. This is Mozart sort of playing on the stereotypes, right? The girl is thinking about the wedding. The guy is thinking about the wedding night. It's just the way it is. That's the way they're doing, okay? Now, but what happens is, he says, this is the perfect room for us. The bed's going to fit in here. All's going to be well. And she says, I don't think it's such a great room. Oh, wait a minute, why not? And she says, well, I think it's too close to the count's bedroom. And he says, no, you don't understand. This is perfect, see? Because at night, when the count needs something, he can just ring his bell, ding, ding, he says, and I can run, bang, I'll be there, I'm just right around the corner, terrific. She says, you don't get it, do you? You're kind of dim, aren't you? These, by the way, are the two smartest people in the opera. So he's not dim, but she likes to play games with him. And of the two of them, oh, let me ask you this. When they sang together, which song did they sing? His or hers? Hers. That's significant, too. Because she's the sharpest tool in the shed. She's the sharpest one of me. She's the quickest. And he knows it. And he's very sharp, too. Both of them, I think, are smarter than the Duke, the Count, and the Countess. Which is a bit of an upheaval, right? Because this is 1783, I think it was written. And so this is just before the French Revolution, where the middle class started telling the upper class to off with their heads, basically, right? This is when Louis, 91, 92, was when Louis and Marie lost their heads, right? Do you all know your French history? The the Bastille, Allons enfants de la patrie, the song of the Bastille. It was about July, what is it, 14th, July 14th, 1789. So this is just 6 years before that revolt, the French Revolution. And what is the story about? It's about two servants that outsmart their masters. And in Vienna, when this opera was staged the first time, it was closed after one performance, I think. Eventually, it was put back on again. But the royalty in Vienna did not want this story played out on in the theaters. It's too dangerous. So here they are singing together, and they're singing her tune. What she says to him when he says this is the perfect room is that you don't get it. The count has designs on me, she says. He's interested in me, see. He wants to play around behind his wife's back. So what he's going to do is ring that little bell of his, and he's going to send you on an errand miles and miles away, and then here I'll be defenseless, see. That's what he wants. Well, that makes Figaro really furious. So then Figaro sings this marvelous aria, Se vuol ballare, signor Contino, which means, if you want to dance, signor Contino, if you want to dance, I'll choose the tune. So right off in the first act of this that it's going to be a little battle of wits between Figaro and Susanna on one side, and the Count on the other, and his designs on Susanna. One other little tidbit to this, and this is all in the music again, this tidbit is that when they sing together at this first scene, we the audience, know that they really do love each other, and that they really are in harmony with each other, they really are going to work everything out, because there are several times in the next three acts that each of them believes the other one to be unfaithful, but without cause. They're not being unfaithful, but they think, each of them is sort of jealous about somebody else. But we, the audience, know from that first scene that everything's going to work out fine. We all know that the two of them are really in love with each other. We heard it in the music. Mozart meant it that way. That's how profound the music is. And all of this is to say why it is that I want Christians to think carefully about how we craft music when we craft it. To know, like the muses, that the mother of the muses is history or is memory. And you have to know your history. You have to know where you came from. You need to stand on the shoulders of those who have done great things in the past if you're going to be a musician or an artist. You have to know your history. You need to be inspired by God. God gives you the gift. So use it wisely. Use it to glorify Him. Not just to entertain yourself or your friends, but to actually see something and craft the music to speak of that something in a way that will reward reflection. Reward second hearings, third hearings, 15th hearings. This is how I think music ought to be addressed and thought of. It's not to say that you can't have fun, lighthearted stuff. I think some of the stuff we've played tonight has even been lighthearted. But that doesn't mean that it has to be silly. It doesn't have to be foolish or worse, lascivious, like a lot of popular music turns out to be. That's not to say that there aren't popular composers that do some good things. There are popular songs that are very well crafted. But I'm more interested in well crafted things than I am momentary diversions, do you see? That's what I want for Christians to be. I'm hoping that you, in your own thinking now, if you haven't been thinking about this before, will have a category in your head for what music could be. So that when you hear things in the future, you might actually be a little disappointed with some things. Because it doesn't scratch where that itch is. You know what I mean? So that you have a category in your mind that tells you there's a way to craft music that is bigger and better than I have seen so far. And now I'm hungry for it. I hope you leave here hungry for more. Okay, I've got to quit. Any questions before I quit? Yes, ma'am.
Do that on purpose, like,
You're catching on.
Okay, if you have questions, write them down.
Ah, right. I forget.